Let's have a podcast. Folks, we've made it to the end of season 12. This is wrapping up what is really like our sixth year worth of the podcast, just the way we break the seasons. We have two each year. So we're going to be wrapping up the podcast here at the end of the spring as we look forward to summer convention season. We already talked with Gary and Lee about that earlier in previous show. Tonight, we've got a big cast. We've got Mo from Mo's Game Table. Mo, welcome. How you doing?
Good. How you guys doing?
I think I'm probably in a similar boat with you that like there's a hockey game on and we're doing a podcast. What's the matter with us?
Hey, but you know what? The Canes are on top right now. Hopefully that stays that way for you.
They are. So anybody that is listening to this like 2 years later can probably go back and figure out when we were recording this. Mike is back, returning to some co-host duties and wrapping up the season with us. Mike, how are you?
I'm good. I can't believe the season's over. We're getting ready to go to Origins pretty soon.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks left, and we'll all be gathering in Columbus. And then before you can catch your breath, that weekend will be over because it always goes quick. It seems like it just goes faster every year. And then Grant is here. Grant, I think this is the first time we've had you for season 12, haven't we?
I think that's right. I think the last time I was on was last season.
And so Grant is just back from the gigantic road trip he does each spring, the pilgrimage to Hanford. How was GMT West?
It was great. You know, the thing about GMT West, I've gone three times now, three or four times, and as opposed to like a convention, it's more like these guys have opened up their warehouse and had all their buddies come over to play games. And it's just kind of chill, you know. It's there's not all that kind of pressure of people selling you stuff or pressure to win tournaments or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the big family reunion, right? It just happens to be at the warehouse.
Yep.
And GMT doesn't need to pressure anybody into buying anything.
That's true. Well, in fact, on the Saturday, they always throw open the warehouse and say, 50% off on whatever you want to buy today. So, they're doing the opposite of soaking us for money that way.
That's awesome and dangerous, yeah.
That's why Grant goes back home with like the tail end of the car sagging the whole way.
So. Not as much anymore. The first time I went, I probably bought 8 games. This time I only bought 3.
When you go to a convention like that, you always bring an extra suitcase.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm guessing the road trip doesn't get any shorter though, does it?
No, but it's pretty. I get to go down through Montana, Utah, Oregon. Depends which route I take. You know, there's a lot of pretty states to drive through.
Yes. Yeah, there is some good scenery out there. Guys, again, looking at the state of hobby wargaming, and like there's about 1,400 different directions we can take this, but Grant talking about GMT weekend at the warehouse, I think is as good a starting point as any, because I think for a lot of folks in the wargaming world, GMT sort of is the standard setter for many of the publishers in the wargaming world. They're the biggest publisher, probably both by volume and dollar figures, although you'll never get an official answer from those guys. I think we can all recognize that some of those games are on like the 38th printing, right? I mean, they're kind of the big dog in the house. And yes, there are some others that are starting to catch up on volume, especially Compass, but I think GMT is still pretty much the flag bearer for the industry there, having, taken that over the years. Mo, I'll throw it to you first. Any particular thoughts on sort of not just GMT being out front and kind of where they set the standard, but how long you expect them to stay on top, projected challengers? Grab that and run in whatever direction you want.
Well, I mean, right now, as far as the publishing space goes, they're still the big dog. They've been for, a couple decades now. They've grown into the big dog, and they're now diversifying from war games into the Euro space more and attracting that that audience as well. So that's good for them because now they're kind of broadening their audience. And at the same time, it opens it up to the other, publishers like Compass and Legion and all that are making war games only, and they're just doing that. So it's kind of a good time for everybody because now you're getting a more broad audience and more broad product, and everyone is, GMT is doing what they're doing, Compass is doing what they're doing, Legion's doing what they're doing, so on and so forth. And everyone's kind of just upping their volumes and upping their game, which is great for us, I think.
Grant, what do you think?
I totally agree with Mo. The thing that's been exciting for me is it feels like there's like every couple of months, I find out about a new little publisher coming out of Europe or something. Like the other day, I got a game from a new publisher in England called Form Square. The game's called Bonaparte's Eastern Empire. It's on the Egyptian campaign. But it was like, you know, I'd never heard of these guys before. They're brand new. You know, VUCA has been around for a little while now, but they still feel like a new publisher on the block. There, it seems like there's four or five out of Spain as well. So it feels like even though GMT and Compass and MMP, I guess, are the big dogs on the block, that doesn't seem to mean that there's not room for a bunch of these smaller publishers as well.
Mike, what do you think?
I'm going to agree with Mo and Grant because those are both very good points. And I'm going to, you know, I'll take it even further in that, you know, GMT's been around since, like, I guess, the early 90s, and Compass, I don't know when they showed up on the scene, but probably not too much longer after that. And now we do have all these other smaller publishers out there. There's just, you know, how does that compare to back in the Avalon Hill days? I mean, it's just crazy. And on top of that, the third thing I think is, if you want to make your own game and print it out yourself, that you can do that now. There's the resources online for you to go create a 22 by 34 inch game board, counters, tokens, dice, customize everything and print your own game. And not just print your own game, but I took a Federation Space and updated it and made my own copy. And it costs about the same as what a brand new game would cost today to create that copy of the game. So yeah, we have, there's just a lot more available to us than what there was initially.
And to Mike's point, to jump in here, kind of expand on it a little bit, you can make your own games, and there's a lot of designers that are out there making games, you know, the book games and things like that, and print and play games where you can do just that. You can take these print and play games for either free or for low cost, and then you can go print them through different publishing services, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, and I didn't even mention digital, right? Tabletop Simulator. You could probably create your own game in Vassal from scratch too, I imagine.
There are plenty of people who have. Just at the ACDC this January, we had the guys that are working on the Code Atlas game, which is sort of a modern and near future kind of Axis and Allies flavored game, that are doing all of their prototyping and testing in Tabletop Simulator well in advance of attempting any sort of physical production. Part of that is because the team is spread out. Part of that is because it's really cheap to copy and paste something in Tabletop Simulator as opposed to having to go buy new bits and bobs to use on whatever iteration of the map you're working on. So they're not the first people to rely on that for the initial development. And I don't think we're too far away from somebody releasing something pretty much exclusively on Tabletop Simulator or Vassal and, you know, hey guys, we're never sending this to print. It doesn't make financial sense for us. I wouldn't be surprised to see one of those.
Also, in terms of the print and play thing, your initial thought about that might be that it's, new designers or first-time designers, whatever. But guys like Brian Train, like really established designers, on top of all the games he has published through Hall & Spiel or GMT or wherever else, he's got a whole bucket full of games that are just available via print and play. So, you know, they're like, There's really good designers who work in that space as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Wargame Vault exists for a reason. Like if there wasn't a demand for it, it wouldn't be there. I personally am not a huge fan of the arts and crafts necessary to assemble print and play games. I've assembled some of my own prototypes, but I know a lot of people who have a pretty solid system for the way they like to put those together, and they're perfectly happy doing so. And I think that's a great way to get a lot of games out in people's hands without a lot of upfront expense on creating them. Counters, especially in our space, like role-playing games are pretty easy, right? You go down to the photocopy shop and make a bunch of books and saddle stitch them and mail them out, because you don't have to worry about like mounted counters on a map. One of the things I've noticed, Grant, you mentioned Form Square Games. Folks know, like, we've got our Tuesday Newsday, right? That's something that I'm the primary contributor to, but I get input from all kinds of different folks in all kinds of different places that send me links or heads up, hey, pay attention to this. But I think I've mentioned this before, you know, when I sit down to finalize Tuesday Newsday, I've got a Tuesday Newsday folder that I pop open on my desktop. And right now, the publishers folder in there is, whoops, hold on, I'm trying to open it up and tell you, 72 tabs And that's not everybody, because there's a handful of publishers that I stopped tracking because they just, their website hadn't changed in like 3 years. Right. Academy Games website hadn't changed in 3-4 years. When they announce something, I'm subscribed to their email list. I don't need to check their website every day. There's probably about a half a dozen publishers that fit into that category. There's two or three more I'm about to put in that category because their sites haven't changed in forever. And there's only about a half a dozen of those that are primarily digital companies, right? Matrix Games, HPS Sims, War Game Design Studio. There's a couple of those we keep up with. So I mean, we're talking easily, you know, subtract a couple of digital ones, put back a couple of them I don't keep up with, between 75, 80 war game publishers, just the ones that I'm aware of. And that doesn't count, because I've got them stored in a different folder. That doesn't count folks like the guys selling exclusively through Amazon, like the Art of War Games or the Mike Lambo stuff. Those guys are in a different folder. In the master folder of Tuesday Newsday stuff. I mean, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that we realistically have about 100 different war game publishers running around out there. Hey, Mo, what do you think?
I agree. I definitely agree, because a lot of that is due to self-publishing now. You can just create a PDF, put it up on War Game Vault, or you can go to Blue Panther, have them print it, or multiple other options you can go to print, or even go through Amazon and just print a book. So it's a lot easier now. The lift is a lot lighter for designers to get their games to market, whereas before you had to pitch a publisher and get them on board before you even could get that thing into development process. Now you can, if you got a core group of guys that are, you know, willing to work with you, and you can get through your development and along with your design, you can get that game out a lot easier. Which is, it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's good and bad. It's good because it gets a lot more games out there, gets a lot more designers noticed a lot faster, but you can get some bad games in there as well. But there's some clunkers when it comes to the big publishers too. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. I think it's great that more people are getting the exposure. I'd rather have more people getting the exposure, and you get those diamonds in the rough, so to speak, that you can kind of polish up and see just shine over time.
Yeah, you mentioned Blue Panther. Like I track Blue Panther as a unified site, because the way Steve lists the games, the new releases on his site, it keeps me from having to go track several of the publishers he supports all separately. So like White Dog and Hollenspiel and Catastrophe, I go track those guys' sites separately, but Blue Panther, you're right. I mean, they've got stuff from Red Sash Games and Paul Koenig and Bill Molyneux. And so there's, you know, Blue Panther's a stand-in for like four or five other publishers also. So that just, you know, ticks the number a little bit higher there.
Starting to do Carrie's games now too. Carrie Anderson with Smoke Jumpers being the first one from Microgame Design Group.
But I don't count him separately there, because I've got Microgame Design Group as a separate tab already that I'm keeping up with.
Yeah, but I mean, it's nice that they're also now going to be under the Blue Panther label. So a lot more people will get notice of those games that I think a lot of people have overlooked prior to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mike, what do you think?
So Blue Panther is continuing to grow. Maybe they'll be behind Compass or one of those. It's good to see, though, right? I mean, Blue Panther started off small, and now look at them. It's crazy.
Well, I think the goal of most folks is to start small and grow, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, they're really growing.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and I think another thing, thinking about it, Mo mentioned, I think it was Mo that mentioned all the little self-publishers that are out there. They aren't really publishers. They're just people who do their own print and play games. And I forget the name of the website. There's a place you can go and actually upload these things, and people can either buy them or print them out for free. But I think what's missing, and this may be a different podcast topic, and maybe we've talked about doing this podcast, but I think what's missing is there's really no one that I can think of that actually kind of scours through the mass of, like, I guess you would call it fan games or whatever, to kind of pick out the gems, the ones that really need more attention, and kind of maybe give them some of these companies some insight to what's going on out there. Maybe there's more games that might get published that way from the people that are just trying to, you know, get their game published.
Well, there are a handful of folks that were in print and play types of environments that have gotten picked up by other publishers. At least two of Catastrophe Games releases were winners of contests on BGG that Tim reached out to and said, hey, I saw your game won this contest. I played it. It's pretty cool. I'd like to publish it. Let's have a chat. And was able to bring those games into the fold that way. I know a couple of them have moved on to bigger crowdfunding. Airborne in My Pocket is the one that comes immediately to mind. Although that crowdfunding campaign turned out to be a bit of a train wreck. But that was always a pretty neat print and play game, a bit of a tile laying tactical game where you sort of unfold the map as you move through it. And then so that one, you know, has moved on that way. And then there were some other fan-made games. One of them, quite frankly, started as a blatant ripoff, and the publisher ended up reaching out to the guy and saying, hey, I'd be interested in publishing this. Back when Mark Walker was running Lock and Load Publishing, there was a guy who put out the Nuclear Winter game that was a straight-up World at War ripoff, just moved into a more of a sci-fi setting, and Mark thought it looked kind of cool and reached out to the guy, and they came to an agreement, and they ended up releasing Nuclear Winter under the Lock and Load banner back when Mark was running the company. So there's been a couple of different cases, Mike, of exactly what you're talking about, of people self-developing something and then a publisher reaching out and picking them up.
Yeah, so, well, you mentioned Catastrophe, and I think Fort Circle's another one that, in fact, I think at Origins are going to be doing just this, where they have people come up and talk to them about their game design, or, you know, see if they want to actually follow up and publish a game. But I guess what I was talking about is more, and those are instances of more of, you know, they're saying, hey, if you got this idea, come to us. But I don't see anything where anybody's going out, and maybe this is something the Armchair Dragoons ought to look into doing, and just filtering and ciphering through all these games out there and just kind of highlighting, you know, like the top five or top 10 games that they think are very interesting. Because otherwise those games just sit there in this database somewhere, and no one really knows they're even out there.
Mike, let me know when the article's ready to go, dude.
And I knew he was going to say that.
I totally hear you, Mike, because I think of like a place like War Game Vault, where they have, you know, I think that's kind of like maybe the main place where people can upload their own designs and sell them for, you know, really a little amount of money and have them sort of published in a print and play way. And I thought, yeah, Mike's got a great idea. Somebody should jump on that and wade through all that stuff. And then I thought, my God, like I have enough trouble wading through all the professionally printed stuff that comes my way or comes across my desk. There's no way I could like wade through all the War Game Vault stuff on top of all that.
Yeah.
It would be That's a lot. Why we're glad that Mike has volunteered to do it.
Coming up on My Own Worst Enemy.
That's true. There you did. You shot yourself in the foot. Once
You're
more.
Living up to your name brand right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hear you, Mike. I mean, there are some cases where folks had, you know, put their own thing together and gone to a publisher and said, hey, please do this. There are cases where folks put their own thing together and just they were happy to just let it sit there and a publisher reached out to them. There's plenty of people that are just happy to let it sit there. I do find it interesting that there's some things that Mike, you've mentioned sort of the good old games of wargaming, right? Bring back some classic stuff in almost print on demand formats. There are a couple of older things that are starting to show up on War Game Vault. There's one guy who I'd be interested in knowing exactly how legal the rights are, but I don't want to accuse anybody of misbehavior without knowing all the. I'm just curious, like how they got the rights to all the old Fire and Movement magazines and have been slowly digitizing those and putting them up on War Game Vault in like 5-issue packs. I think that's fantastic that they're there and they're available. I just hope nobody gets in trouble for it. I really hope that is 100% above board, because we've seen too many cases of where it wasn't that I'm just always immediately skeptical when I see that. You know, I'm not accusing anybody of impropriety. I'm just saying the track record of other people having, you know, engaged in some shenanigans always gives me pause. Grant, you're shaking your head, man.
Well, I'm with you. I'm so happy to see stuff like that happen. I remember like a decade ago when it first started to happen with the old Avalon Hill General magazines, and there was people that were digitizing them and trying to make a buck off it. And that always sort of sucked. When it comes to these old magazines, if they're going to be available, I'd much rather see it where somebody puts the work in to make them available, but doesn't actually make a profit off of the you know, the original publisher's work when the original publisher isn't getting a penny.
Obviously, one way to look at the state of hobby wargaming is in just the sheer number of games produced. And I think all of us are in that content creation space where it's not really our job, right? It's our avocation, because it's our second job. Well, Mike, it's kind of your job now that you're retired from your other one.
There you go.
It's a, to sort of keep up with what's out there in the war game space. You know, one of the main ways I do it is through the stuff I do with Tuesday Newsday and some of the conventions and events we do. Mo, you do a lot of not just, you know, here's the new game video, but a lot of teach and play kinds of things where you're talking with designers to help make that happen. Grant, you get a lot of interviews with folks out there and have them come on your show and talk about what's going on. That said, I think there's times where even amongst the four of us, combined would be drinking from a fire hose with how many new releases are out there and how hard it is to keep up with them all. Mo, what do you think, man? How, if at all, do you even try to keep up with them all?
I used to try to keep up with them all. Now I just try to keep up with some because you have to be a little more selective now because there are so many games out there and a lot of small publishers or the self-published, especially they're really starting to expand quite a bit, which is, like I said before, is fantastic. So you let them do their own sales. And then of course the best salespeople for them is going to be the people who go buy that $5 PDF or that $20 book on Amazon and play it and say, wow, you guys got to play. This is fantastic. Mike Lambeau is a great example of that. His games have been getting so much advocacy from the fan base alone that has brought it to the attention of pretty much everybody now, which is kudos to him. Great work on his part. And he's just a machine cranking out those games one after the other. And then the fans, they like them. They connected with them so much that they're supporting it. And it's just grown organically, which I think is fantastic for him. Whereas the publishers have to work at it a little harder. And that's where that self-publishing is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Grant, how, if at all, do you even try to keep up with this stuff?
I try to set some boundaries for myself. Like I go, okay, I'm not going to do anything with solo games. I'm not going to do anything with multiplayer games, two or three people most. I'm not going to do fantasy games. I'm not going to do science fiction games. And I like all that other stuff a little bit, but I just try to keep, you know, put some boundaries on what I'm going to do. And I still can't keep up with it. It's still a fire hose, which, you know, we're spoiled for choice for what we're going to look at and talk about. But at the same time, sometimes I feel like it's a bit like when back in the day when there was only three channels on TV and we were all talking about the same shows every Monday morning or every Thursday morning. And now, like, we don't have any of those water cooler moments about war game discussions. Like, we're all talking about something different, it seems. Like, even if something captures our attention, all of our attentions for a moment, it just doesn't last, you know? Like, I guess that's it. I sort of missed the thing where everybody was talking about the same thing, even just for a bit, so that we could talk to each other a little bit more about stuff.
There's always ASL.
Well, I think that's also good because it also adds to the fact that we have so much space available in the content creation area too. We have, you know, with everybody on, you know, having YouTube channels or podcasts, things like that, this varied landscape that we have of games allows everybody to find their little area that they like to cover, and they can grow their audience from that rather than trying to cover the entire gamut of gaming. They can try to concentrate on whatever games they specifically like. Say, hey, I know I want this game here. I'm going to go to Grant's channel. I'm going to go to Mike's channel because I know these guys like those games. So they'll go there. And this allows the space to grow by having that opening there for everybody who wants to have a place to speak. They can go out there and create their own channel.
There's only one YouTube channel that keeps up with everything, and that's the Player's Aid. And one day we're going to find their spaceship.
But even they don't, though. That's the thing, because the bigger stuff, like the deeper detailed monster series, like MMP publishes with BCS and OCS and the both GMT and MMP with the Great Battles and Great Campaigns series of the American Civil War. I mean, those guys won't touch those. I don't think you've ever seen Thin Red Line Games stuff show up on the Player's Aid channels. I could be mistaken, but that level of monster game, I just don't think those guys are going to touch them because there are so many other games they want to get to that the 4 week investment it takes for one of those, how many other games are they not covering as a result of that? Grant Alexander, if you guys are listening and I'm just way off base, please feel free to yell at me and correct me. And that's cool. But I just think they're after a slightly different space there. But in terms of those lighter things, yeah, absolutely. Like, those guys are content machines, and I have no idea when they sleep. theoretically, they have day jobs. I have no idea how they manage to do both. So it's a little crazy. Grant, I think you're right. There's a certain point at which you've got to sort of set some boundaries and figure out what those boundaries are. I am so far failing. I'm not very good at it.
Find the boundaries or they will find you is the mantra you should repeat to yourself daily, because if you try to keep up with it, you'll just get overwhelmed. You throw your hands up in the air and say, ah, screw it. I can't do it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I just need some more writers on staff, so I have other people to hand stuff out to, and that'll be my boundary. Right. I have other people to give this to.
So that's Grant's call for recruiting. If anybody's listening right now, wants to get part of Armchair Dragoons, go ahead and join up.
I'm always happy to have more writers, folks that are interested in wanting to share their writing about wargaming. Happy to have it and have plenty of time under my belt as an editor too. So even if you don't think you'd be all that great at it, don't sell yourself short. We can certainly make all kinds of great publications out of stuff folks send us. We're happy to do it. That wasn't the intent of tonight's show though. Grant, you just coming back from GMT West, and me and Gary having spent last weekend at Buckeye Game Fest, and there was Stack Academy going on. There were a couple other things over the past 2 weeks or so. There's plenty of convention stuff out there these days. If you're a wargamer, you're not short of opportunities to go play at a local convention, and not necessarily for the shopping bazaar, the giant market of the vendor hall that you really only get at big conventions anymore these days, but there's a lot of really good gameplay focused local conventions running around out there. Grant, other than GMT West, you've done SD HistCon. Much else? Have you ever made it to BottosCon or any of the others?
No, BottosCon comes around the same time as GMT West in the fall. So one of these years I have to decide to go. I need to go out to Vancouver instead of going south to Hanford. And I got to check it out, because also I think I could talk Brian Train into meeting me at the BottosCon. So it'd be nice to meet him. I've only talked to him online a couple times, and I'd like to meet him in person since he's a fellow Canuck gamer.
Yeah. Well, he's right there in town. I mean, he's not right there in town. Relatively speaking, he's right there in town. Yeah, I mean, he's 30 miles north or whatever it is. So not that far. But other than SD HIST and GMT West, have you made it to any others out there?
No, not at all. The only other thing is I've done locally here in Calgary, ASL conventions.
Okay. Because there's an ASL convention everywhere at some point.
That's right. It feels like in so many ways we're in like another golden age of wargaming, right? There's more games than we can possibly play. There's big games, little games, big publishers, little publishers. The internet has been fantastic in terms of content creation. You know, you can watch videos, you can listen to podcasts, you can go to websites and read printed stuff. So I feel like 95% of the answer to your question about what the state of the hobby is positive. But I do think there are a few things that are lacking at the moment. I wondered if maybe we wanted to talk about those sorts of things as well.
Let's hold that thought. Let's get Mike and Mo's input on the convention front, and then we will come back around to places where we could definitely use some improvement. So Mo, I know you've got Compass that you normally hit. You're going to have FoxCon right there with you in Dallas this year. I don't know that you've done some WBCs here and there, but I don't know if you've done a Consim World Expo or one of the others. What have you hit, and how much fun was it?
Well, I went to CSW Dallas when I was here. Never can make it out to Consim World in Tempe because the scheduling is always bad. This year, it's going to be pretty much right around the same time as my 25th anniversary. So okay, do I go on an Alaska cruise or do I go to CSW? I would love to do both, but I have to choose one or the other. I'd like to stay married. So yes, off to my trip it'll be. But yeah, one of these years I'll get out there to Tempe. And of course, in November, it's always Compass. I just keep my convention stuff down to a minimum, especially being on my schedule is pretty jam-packed all the time. We were talking about prior to the show, hockey season's over now, so I get my weekends back, so that's nice. But that's only till October, and then that all starts back up again as well.
Yeah. We got to figure out when in October, because we got to figure out if we're able to like draft you into coming to ours coming up in October.
I haven't even seen the schedule for next year yet, so I don't know when we're starting in October.
Yeah, maybe cutting it a little close. Mike, I know you've got multiple Origins under your belt at this point. You've got at least one Armchair Dragoons Fall Assembly. What else, if anything, do you have for some conventions, and what are your thoughts on kind of where conventions are in the hobby wargaming space at the moment?
Well, like Grant said, there's I think there's a lot of conventions. I've You know, I was supposed to go to Buckeye Game Fest last week, and that fell through. And that was my second attempt at trying to get out to that. So hopefully next year I'll be able to get to Buckeye Game Fest. But yeah, we know that I've been to the one and only Fall Assembly, which was, I encourage everybody to go to that one. It's small, but it's a lot of fun. But I mean, yeah, overall, if you want to go to a convention and you're a war gamer, I think you've got a lot of choices on, you know, both coasts and the center of the country too, right?
Yeah.
And we haven't been talking online ones, like your armchair, you guys have the online one, and Harold's he's got his online one, the San Diego HISCON. He's got another version of that coming up in June. I'm going to participate in that. I've like where my city is, it's a long way to get to anywhere in terms of conventions, so I've been so thankful to both the ACDC and the SD HISCON online. Those things have just been fantastic for me, and I'm sure they've been fantastic for a lot of other gamers that aren't physically close to where a lot of the live action is happening.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on the convention stuff because we did talk about them a bunch with Gary and Lee a couple weeks ago leading into BGF and then looking forward to Origins. But for war game focused conventions, I don't want to call them war game specific because many of them will have some other things there. Whether it's Historic KC Fest right there in Kansas City or the multiple Compass Cons that they now have, CSW Expo has always been sort of the standard bearer, but SD HISCON continues to grow. Circle DC is now in its second year. It continues to grow, but it's got some attendance limits just because the fire marshal is only going to let so many people in the building they use. You know, you've got a whole bunch of these different, you know, Buckeye Game Fest is not a war game focused convention. There's maybe, I don't know, 15-20% of the convention there are war gamers, but they have a dedicated room for the war gamers there, and it opens up several days ahead of the convention that you're able to put a bunch of monster games down on there. You do have Winterfest, which is almost all monster games, and they can get a really cheap hotel banquet room set aside for them because nobody wants to go to Sandusky in February, so it's very easy to get a cheap room at the hotel there for setting up a bunch of monster games for 10 days. And we haven't even touched the ASL conventions that are everywhere. We've had one here in Raleigh forever that I didn't even know about until like a year ago. Not that I'm a big ASL player, but the Bitter Ender convention has been going on here forever. And that doesn't include all the HMGS mini stuff that's going on. That doesn't count Adepticon. That doesn't count, WBC, which is not just war game. Mo, you've been to WBC. What's the war game to non-war game ratio up there?
Well, I'm probably a bad person to ask that because if I'm around war games and non-war games, the war games are my focus. Everything else is blurry and out of focus. So I don't really pay a lot of mind to it. I do know that there was general gaming out there as well, but I really was so wrapped up in the war gaming portion of it that all I saw were the war games. I did see other games too, and I know there were tournaments going for all different types of games, but I pretty much, the war gamers tended to stay pretty close together in their own areas. So it was all I really was seeing was war games. When I would pass through and I'd see other non-war games, I was like, oh yeah, there's other games here. Okay, onto the war game section. And that's where I, you know, spent the majority of my time. But I know that they have a good showing for non-war games as well.
But you're the only one of the three of us that's been to the four of us that's been to WBC. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great thing. And I think a lot of the people who are going there for the non-war games and even war gamers too, that go there for they're in search of the wood. They want to go win a tournament. It's great for that because people want to compete. Then that's where you want to go. You want to go to WBC. Me, I'm not a tournament gamer. I never will be. It's just not my thing. So I don't really concern myself with the tournament side of things. I just like the open gaming, the demos, and then the people who are saying, hey, we're going to play this for the next few days. And then you sit down and play that for the next few days. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you get some protected time with your friends, one of the great things about conventions, and a friend of mine has pointed this out, it's sort of when you're at the convention, you've given yourself permission to ignore the rest of your life, right? You're at the convention. Everything else is kind of walled off. You're not having to check the work email on the side. You're not having to worry about, getting kids to and from soccer practice. You're not having to worry about the boss calling you. You're not having to worry about cutting the grass. Like, you're there at the convention. That's the focus. The rest of it's kind of walled off a little bit. And it gives you the ability to throw a monster game down and play it for four straight days, or, you know, play 17 games in 3 days if you can juggle the timing of it all right. I think that's something that's kind of cool, but I think the fact that there's a lot of different war game conventions and we seem to be growing new ones, mm-hmm. I think is a cool thing. And I think it's something that speaks to the health of the hobby as a whole, that even if you don't have companies there selling stuff, the fact that you have a lot of players wanting to share the experience with each other, I don't see that as in any way, shape or form a bad thing.
No. And the other thing that's good about it too, is unlike some other game conventions, I'm not going to name any, the good thing about war game conventions is, yes, everybody tunes out work and family and just concentrates on games, but we don't tune out hygiene. So that's a good thing.
The 12th season of Mentioned in Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunderborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Grant, you were talking about there's definitely some room for improvement. Right now, there's some room for improvement in the hockey game. I just checked the score. It's 3-3 with under 2 minutes to play. So there's some room for improvement in the damn hockey game. In any event, Grant, where were you going with that thought on some things that we could do better with?
Sure. I've got a couple of thoughts about this. Some of, I guess they're sort of related, but like I said, you know, it's 95% good. But one thing I find with... And I'm part of it, right? Like as a person with a podcast and a YouTube channel, kind of stuff that I do is I do a lot of first looks at things, and I do a lot of teach and play, that sort of stuff. I don't do as much as Mo does, but you know, that's sort of my focus. Like, what is it? How does this game work? Let me help you figure out how it works. What I find that there's a bit of a lack of, that I wish there was more of, and I'm not the guy to do it, is I find there's a more of a lack of real in-depth reviewing that I wish we'd see more of, like the kind of stuff we used to see in Moves magazine or Fire and Movement or the General. I miss Battles magazine for that. It used to have a great in-depth reviews. You know, it's not that it's totally gone. There's still a few guys doing that sort of stuff, whether it's online or in print. But I wish there was more of it, and I wish I had time or the talent to participate in it.
That's why Brant's asking for writers.
I absolutely wish there was more of it, and would be happy to provide an outlet for some of it. You bring up a great point that I think a combination of the time available to the content folks and there are so many new shiny objects out there that we want to go grab and play with. And honestly, I think part of it is a lack of attention span from some of the audience, quite frankly, that there's just not a whole lot of incentive to lay down 10,000 words on a game anymore. And I'm saying this as a guy that's put down 6,000 to 8,000 words on games in the past, in the old days, back in the Wargamers glory days of the mid-aughts, when there was a really talented staff of, you know, a dozen or so great writers, plus me, that were all working there. I mean, a 6,000 to 8,000 word review was normal. If you turned in something under 5,000 words, you were told to, you know, dig into it a little more. That was the norm. But I just wonder, this is all Mo's fault, right? Because Mo's all video. I'm picking on you, Mo. But I think a lot of folks are watching video stuff instead of necessarily reading extended content. And I don't think that's just war games. I think that's a larger evolution of society as a whole, that long form reading and writing is starting to atrophy. I hear you, Grant. I would absolutely love more of that.
Well, the other thing is like, it, you know, it exists a little bit in print still, but I think, you know, like a guy like Callendale, he does pretty deep dives, you know, he'll take a long look at something. So it still does exist in video, but I think with a lot of us doing video, there's a lot of, like, people who will play a game once and then review it. And to me, that's not really a review. That's, you know, that's a first look at a game, right? That's not a deep dive. You got to play a game a few times before you can really review it properly.
I think, well, that's the only thing too is time, you know.
That's what I was going to say. I think that in order to do that with a video channel is, you know, if I were going to review, and I try not to do a review on my channel. I'll say I'll do a first look at or something like that. But to actually call something a review, I don't think I've ever done that because, and it's not, I don't necessarily agree that, you know, you've got to play a game 10 times, 20 times to write a decent review. I mean, I don't know about other people, but I can read a rule book and get a pretty good feel of whether or not I'm going to like a game. And I can just from reading a rule book, get at least a base to expand from. But to do a really in-depth, thorough review, yeah, I would want to sit down and play the game multiple times, read the rule book multiple times, and then that's the first step. That how much time is that going to take? Then you've got to sit down and record the video, and that's going to take time. And then if you've ever edited a video, then you can take that time, multiply it by 10, and that's going to take that much time to get it posted. So it's a very time-consuming process, I think.
I agree, and I think that's why I have my, you know, talking about playing a game like 10 times to get a really good feel of it. That's why I have my campaign for North Africa review scheduled for 2057, because that's about time I may have gotten in 10 plays. I'll long be dead by then, but the thing about it is, it's true. I mean, there are some games like I was just playing with Licky Looky last week, and I played it like two or three times, actually. I hadn't played a third. That's the type of game. It's like 7 pages of rules, real small, small footprint, low counter density. You could literally play that it twice and provide a review on it, although playing it 3 or 4 times probably give you a little bit more insight, but generally you get the insight you need to get right off the bat. Plus it's a $16 game. How deep of a dive are you going to go into it? And, you know, someone had mentioned, I think it was Grant was talking about somebody like Callendale. None of us can compete with his stream of consciousness. He just goes off. I mean, all you need to do is put on some Pink Floyd and sit down and listen to him, and you're good to go for, you're going to go on a hell of a trip. I'll put it that way.
Borrow a pipe from Dan.
There you go.
I think that might've been what Callendale did a couple of times.
But I, to Grant's point, he's right. I mean, there is definitely room for improvement there, but we also, then it begs the question, how deep do we go into these games and how much is it going to be consumed and appreciated by the audiences? Because, you know, I've done some reviews. I'm kind of like Mike. I don't do a lot of reviews. I do some on the channel, but I kind of hesitate to do them because they don't get a lot of views. They don't get a lot of engagement for some reason. And, you know, I try not to do too many of the deeper games because of that. It's like, okay, am I going to put this much time and effort into reviewing a game that is going to require more time and effort when it's not going to get the engagement? And if you do it, and are you really, number one, going to get the engagement? Number two, you know that there's always going to be somebody come in and say, you're wrong. And it's like, okay, not that we're saying that we need to be right or wrong, but there's always going to be someone who's going to come in and try to rain on the parade, or, oh, you totally played that rule wrong or something, because these games are complex and we are making mistakes as we play. Everyone does, you know? So how can we be sure that we are getting the right amount of gameplays and playing it 100% correctly to give a good review?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that.
I don't think you're ever going to, I don't care how good you are, you're going to make a mistake when you're playing a game. I mean, it could be your favorite game. You could play it thousands of times. You're going to make a mistake once in a while. You forget to do something. Everybody does. And that's another reason why you don't see what I call a tutorial on my channel, or, you know, instructional videos, just for that reason. I do playthroughs, and I tell you up front, I'm going to make mistakes. I want you to call them out so we can learn the game together. And people that watch these videos are going to learn with us. But yeah, that it's extremely time consuming. And then the chatter heads that chime in if you make a little mistake. And I've been pretty fortunate on my channel. I mean, I get comments once in a while, but nothing like what I've seen other people get sometimes on their channels with some of the comments.
Yeah, I've been fortunate too. I haven't had too much of that, but I have seen them on other channels, and I've seen them in written reviews and written comments. There's always that little, you know, the kind of the barb throwing back and forth. It's like, it's not benefiting anyone. And the ones that, you know, want to be the most critical, I go, and what's your channel and what are you contributing to the community? You know, not to come off like a jerk, but if you're going to be critical on other people's stuff because you think you're doing it better, then how come you aren't? And there's plenty of room to join in and be a voice in the community. We want that. We want to see that level of engagement. Maybe that person has a better eye than you or I do in picking something up in a game and talking about it in a critical nature, which it's like, hey, that benefits the community getting involved.
I find that often when those little things pop up on my channels, that other viewers or listeners are quicker than me to jump to my defense. So sometimes that takes care of itself pretty quickly. But I hear you. Those guys are kind of, well, you know, they're everywhere. I was thinking as we were talking, though, I think one of the things, like I totally agree, it takes so much time to do the really deep dive, the big review. That, you know, if it's a written piece, a 8 or 10,000 word piece, or if it's a really detailed video review, all that time playing the game, especially if it's a bigger game, playing the game, writing the review before you even shoot it, and then editing it, it takes a colossal amount of time. And I've heard people complaining, you know, that there's not these kind of reviews out there. Like, I'm not the only one to say it, but it also strikes me that, like, this is the kind of thing that people used to be paid to do. You know, you used to get paid to write a review like that in the General or whatever, and you know, nobody's getting paid to do this, the kind of work that it takes to do that. And it's much easier to do a first look, like the kind of stuff that I do, or a playthrough, or a how to play like that. You know, nobody's paying me to do it, but it doesn't take me 70 hours to do it either.
I think once upon a time, folks were paid to do it.
Yeah.
And honestly, it wasn't that long ago. It was within about the past, you know, 10 to 15 years that you had folks legitimately getting paid for written contributions, mostly to print magazines. But there were even some websites with staffs that were paying folks. And they were largely ad-supported websites. A couple of them had some subscription model to them. I think one of the differences you've got now is there are two things going on. One, for some folks, they're able to set up their written space in a place that handles some of that monetization for them, whether it's Substack or Medium, or there's a couple of different sites where you can kind of publish your own newsletters that folks can subscribe to, but the site, handles all the back end subscription piece, such that you as an individual can get paid for taking the time to do that material. The other thing is, if I've got to figure out a way to fund a site that is paying its writers, then that site's having to compete with literally everybody else that's just got a blog out there that they're just going to throw up for dirt cheap or free and just start writing to because they can. And the barrier to entry in that content creation space is so incredibly low that literally everybody can hang out a shingle. All four of us have.
Yep.
And there's no shortage of people who are doing that. Some monetized, most not. But most of the ones not monetized are going to do it anyway because it's just something they enjoy doing. So given how low we've made those barriers to entry and how much information people can get from the people not willing to charge for it, it's hard to build an economic model that would incentivize the quality content contributors to do the work in such a way that they could get paid for it. It's unfortunate, but that's just kind of the cycle we're in with today's media landscape. I'm saying this as a dude who's tracked communication technology for many, many years as a part of my academic background.
It's absolutely true. It's exactly where we are in the, you know, we've seen the magazine racks at our local drugstore or supermarket dwindle. Like print has been wiped out by the internet for sure, just in terms of the way the internet has sucked all the advertising away.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You guys don't have your own chalets and your own yachts and everything? Because that's what everybody always says. You guys with your big YouTube money, it's like, if you've ever seen the YouTube dollars that people get, I think you'd be surprised. It's like, wow, you might be able to get a Ziploc game.
People get YouTube dollars?
Well, you got to join the big time. Apparently, you don't have the big crowds yet to make the big dollars.
Come on, three subscribers is a lot.
There's tens of cents to be made.
There was, you know, even in largely successful areas, our long ago mentor in the wargaming content creation and forum space, when Mr. Zabek was still around with us doing a lot of wargaming stuff, he and I were having a conversation one day, and he was talking to some guys from a digital game development house, and I'm not going to tell you who it was because because they've never given anybody permission to tell the story publicly, but it's games you would recognize, let's say it that way. Ones that were massive successes in the digital wargaming space, which, yes, that's not a huge space. We're not competing with Call of Duty here, but still, I mean, these were runaway hits in the digital wargaming space. And we're having a conversation about sort of how much time did you spend working on the game? How much time did you spend perfecting the game? Because as much as we talk about trying to get a tabletop game engine right, even if you get the engine perfect on the digital side, you've still got a ton of code bugs you got to go clean up. That's way worse than hunting for typos in a rule book. As a guy who's done both, I can promise you it's way worse than hunting typos in a rule book. Never mind that your hourly rate at the end of all this works out to being like 38 cents an hour. Just sort of, what did you get back as a check based on the standard royalties, the sign-on bonus, but then figuring out some of your expenses for your equipment and your material and, you know, paying for your subscriptions to the code writing software and all those things. You know, at the end of it all, the dude basically bought himself a really nice Pottery Barn coffee table. Like that was for a runaway hit in the digital wargaming space. You know, you cleared $3,000-ish, you know, and that's for the designers. That's not content creator folks, you know, and pennies on the hundreds of views for YouTube and whatever other, you know, donation or Ko-fi or Patreon subscription money you can get from someone. All our money gets dunked right back into running the site for, you know, some shipping costs to get some games moved around, but basically it's technology costs for us for things like our StreamYard setup and our web hosting and some of those things. You know, when you're a designer who's got a runaway hit going and you've basically bought yourself a coffee table out of 5 years worth of work, man, we ain't doing this for the money, are we?
No, absolutely not. And I, you know, thank goodness for the patrons. And I only have a handful, but I spend way more of my own money on the hobby than, you know, any income I might get from patrons or YouTube or anywhere else. And having that little bit of income is nice. I think people think that, you know, we get us being YouTube content creators that, you know, GMT and Compass and Catastrophe, all these companies are just sending us free copies of all these games that come out. And here you go, guys. I don't get anything. I'm lucky if I get maybe one or two free games a year. And usually when I do get it, I've got to ask for it. Or I'll bug Brant for one if he gets one. What little bit of income I think we get, speaking for myself, goes right back into the channel.
Yeah,
I think for when it comes to YouTube, when compared to what you were talking about before with the designer, they will be able to get a really nice table out of it. A really successful YouTuber will be able to get a really killer set of coasters that'll go on top of that table. That's pretty much about what you're going to get if you're going to get into YouTube. And you guys are talking about Patreons. I don't have any Patreons or anything, so I get nothing from that. I get the occasional somebody will just kind of do it because I have a Ko-fi link. Someone will occasionally give me $5 or something like that. I've had a couple that were even more generous than that. I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it because I want to contribute to the community and I enjoy it. So that is a definite thing that I'm doing just for myself in that regard. But of course, it's appreciated if anybody wants to help offset costs because, you know, the StreamYard for doing Whiskey Charlie and cost for software and things like that, that all adds up. And if you can't offset that one way or the other with, you know, the tens of cents we get from YouTube, then you gotta get it some other way. Otherwise you're funding it all out of your own pocket.
Yeah. And I do it because like you said, I do it one, because I enjoy it. This is my hobby and I enjoy doing it. And two, I want to help the community. I think doing the playthroughs, you know, it's a place for somebody to come and learn how to play a game. If they want to learn how to play a game, watch the video. And yeah, that's why I do it.
Guys, as we start to wrap this up here, we're right around an hour as we're recording this, trying to keep things close to an hour, which is why I'm a little hesitant to ask this. But, you know, Mike, I'll throw it to you first. Looking out over the next 4 to 5 years, do you feel confident in trying to make any sort of prediction about the hobby wargaming space? You know, take a stab at something. Do you have a prediction and whatever level of probability you think it would actually come true there?
Two things that come to mind, and I'd start as far as assigning probabilities to it, I have no idea. Two things. One is, you know, we see AI entering into the art side of board gaming with all the AI generated artwork. I'm wondering what's going to happen in other departments with AI? Are we going to see AI written rule books? Are we going to see AI written scenarios? How involved will that get in the future in wargaming? And then the other thing is, are we going to see more engagement? We talked about this earlier. Are we going to see more engagement with publishers publishing, you know, don't take away our physical copies of games, but when you publish a physical copy of a game, also drop a tabletop module, tabletop simulator module to go with it so that you have access to either or. And I'm hoping we see that in the future.
Yeah. Wagon Load Publishing has actually published the rule books where you can buy just the rule book to use with the digital assets for tabletop simulator. That's something they've been doing for a little while now. So Mo, what do you think? You got a prediction you're willing to stake out here?
The prediction for the next 5 years?
Next 4 to 5 years in the hobby wargame space. What's something you think we're going to see?
Well, number one, it's going to really be depending on the economy, because if the economy stays strong and stays going well, I think these publishers will continue to grow, which is a good thing. And we'll hopefully see more content creators get out there. So anybody who's been considering dipping their toe in the water, definitely jump in and be a voice, help out. I like the idea of expanding the digital aspects of things, more Vassal, more tabletop simulator, maybe even just direct computer ports of board games to the computer that can be played on maybe cross-platform. You could play it on Steam on your computer while you're playing with your friend on their iPad or their phone, even if maybe the game works on a phone, because some of these phones are pretty huge. And you can play cross-platform, so you can play it anytime you want. But as far as the games go themselves, the tabletop games, this is going to sound a little funny, but I'd like to see us dial it back, like see some designers dial it back a little bit. And maybe, because I know a lot of people have been saying they want to go back to the simpler times, simpler games, maybe go back to the shorter rule books, the faster games, smaller footprint, things like that, because you can consume those games a lot quicker. And maybe that would help some of the content creators get more content out there faster and more in-depth reviews like Grant was talking about earlier. Because then you can, you know, kind of get through two or three games, four games in a week, rather than four games in a month or 2 months. And then you have more to say about that game. I think that would be kind of neat. But I think the way things are going right now, I think things are super healthy right now. And they're just going to get more healthy if the economy is there to support it. Because if people don't have disposable income, they're not going to be buying games.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. Grant, shine up your crystal ball. Give us a prediction here. Give us something you'd...
Sure, I got two things I'd like to mention on that. One is, like Mo says, if the economy stays good, and as we mentioned earlier, like there's just a proliferation of new producers and new designers and new games coming out all the time. And I feel like we're living in a time right now where there's some changes coming in some games. Like we're seeing more diversity in games. We're seeing more historical games. We're seeing games that, you know, maybe some of us wouldn't call a war game entering in the war game space. And there's a lot of friction there about what, you know, people are afraid that their games are getting pushed out or something. But I think in the next 5 years, we're all going to understand that it's not a question of one type of game coming and pushing your type of game out. There's just more of all kinds of games. And we're all going to be able to just chill out and go, oh, look, all these new political games that I don't actually enjoy aren't pushing my Hex Encounter games out of the marketplace. And I was crazy to be worried about it. So I feel like, or at least I should say, I hope we're all going to chill out about that and quit protecting our turf a little bit on that. The thing that I hope for is, I mentioned earlier, I really miss Battles Magazine, and I would just love it if we could get another general purpose magazine like that, a magazine that doesn't have a game in it, that isn't related to a game company, but this just kind of covers everything. I know C3I, they're distanced from GMT now, but they still feel really GMT focused. Wargame Diary is sort of in that space, but I guess I miss Battles, and I wish there was more of it, because that they really provided what I wanted in terms of, you know, great reviews, great historical pieces, that sort of stuff. So I'm crossing my fingers that somebody's going to step up to the plate with a new magazine.
Well, you know, Mike is retired.
Game in every one of them.
Battles did, yeah, they did. But I didn't care about the games. What I cared about was the magazine.
Well, Mike is retired, so he has time to do that too. So he can add that to his growing list of tasks to take care of.
As soon as I finish going through all these self-published games for these people.
Exactly.
What you do is go through all the self-published games to write the quality reviews that Grant wants in print form in My Own Worst Enemy magazine.
There you go.
You can double a weekly magazine that, at, you know, at that pace.
Yeah.
I did have one final bold prediction, and that is within the next 5 years, I believe we will see another Gettysburg game.
Yeah. I was going to joke, I don't believe so. I expect to see Stalingrad games, but.
And we might bet you there's going to be a bulge game in there somewhere.
I was going to say, so you beat me to it. Mo beat me to it. I bet we see another bulge game within 5 years.
As a matter of fact, I bet you we're going to see another bulge game in the next couple months.
I bet
you're going to be a pretty big one, too. And I bet you it's going to be called The Last Gamble.
I saw an upcoming Gettysburg game 3 days ago. So Herman's Into the Whirlpool is going to be out within the next, 8 to 10 weeks or so. And so we'll already have that new Gettysburg game, maybe even before we get to Origins. So that one's coming pretty quick.
So the question is, then, are we going to have a Stalingrad game before the end of the summer? Because then we'll have all three. We'll have the trifecta.
And Waterloo by winter.
Yeah. Cole Worley jokingly referred to them as the wargaming stations of the cross.
It's true.
Which I found very hilarious. I'll say, Grant, one of the things that I definitely miss about Battles Magazine was the visual oomph of it. I don't know that we've ever had a better looking wargame magazine. Part of that was Olivier's fantastic eye for photography, that he could make counters on tables look cool with the lighting and the angles and the zooms and the blurs that he would use and the way he would micro focus on just very particular things or shoot a good wide angle shot. He had a way of taking static counters on maps and making them look like action shots, which was really cool.
And his layout, just the layout of the whole magazine, it was bright and lively and engaging. Like even the text looked good. One of my complaints sometimes about War Diary, for example, is that whole thing always feels a bit dark to me. I feel like I'm going into a cave when I read that magazine sometime, as opposed to Battle Magazine, which always felt so bright to me, and I loved it.
Yeah, because they generally would use like the white paper, similar to C3I, and War Diary generally has the backgrounds on those, or at least colored backgrounds, if not a texture or something on there. The one complaint that I had, which was very consistent with Battles Magazine, was the inconsistency of the publication. Would be here, then you wouldn't see it for 2 years, then it would be back. And it was worse than C3I, which is kind of down to once a year now. Maybe twice if you get one at the end and one at the beginning of the year. But it's tough. But yeah, Battles was a great magazine, and they had a really great way game in there. Week in Hell.
We'll have to do some sort of like full episode on magazines down the line somewhere and see what we come up with. Looking a couple of years forward, it's tough to make too many predictions, but two of the ones that I would be willing to throw out there, I think you're going to see another publisher that's going to jump up and join that key trifecta of MMP and Compass and GMT as one of the standard bearers in the industry. I think we're not that far from having a fourth publisher up there that's got consistent in-store presence in the wargaming stores, that there's actual games on shelves where they're not just primarily mail order driven or convention sales driven, although that's always going to be a significant component for every wargame company, but somebody that has a big enough hit, maybe even a crossover hit, but I'd like to think that we've got at least one more wargame company that the combination of volume sales overall, volume number of titles that they're able to start to ramp up to and capturing some retail presence, we're going to add another bigger publisher to the crew out there that will jump up and start to challenge those guys. I don't know who. I'm not brave enough to say that it's, Legion Wargames taking the next step, or some smaller, that Catastrophe Games is going to take off like a rocket once Tim retires from the military and his civilian job and focuses on the maybe it is going to be one of them. Maybe it's somebody we hadn't even thought of yet. Maybe it's one of the European publishers.
I think it's going to be VUCA. Is the only flaw VUCA has is they need to, and they're young enough where they can grow into this. Is their shortcoming is development. If they get a better development cycle in place, they get a good development team or teams in place, they're going to be cranking out fantastic games, because they already are on par with if not above, everyone else production quality wise. Now, what they need to do is they need to just get the development down tight to where when they release the games, they're out there, they've kind of worked out the majority of the bugs. They're not having to come back and redo pieces of the game because there are things that were missing or done incorrectly or whatever. They get that ironed out, and they've got plenty of time to do it. They get that ironed out. I think they're going to be right up there at the top.
Yeah, but I think there's some business things VUCA is going to need to sort out as well, such as getting into regular retail distribution. The other thing is right now, as fantastic as VUCA's production values are, everything VUCA's publishing right now exists in that $90 to $120 space, and they don't have any smaller on-ramps to get people into the company yet. They may get there.
Boutique still, yeah.
Yeah. They may get there. And if they're the one, great. I'm going to be happy no matter who it is. There's one exception I won't talk about just because I think the person's a schmuck. But there's, but by and large.
That'll be in the next episode, everybody.
Aside from one exception out there, I would be happy for it. I think we're starting to develop enough that I think we're going to have another one jump up there. And so I really hope that that's the case within the next couple of years.
Another one I'd throw out there is Revolution. With the success of their Blind Swords, and then now I guess the Micronella solitaire game, his Stalingrad and Manila solitaire games are selling like hotcakes. That could help to give them the oomph to take the next step as well. I always think of them as about this sort of the same size as Legion. I don't know if that's correct or not, but they feel like they're a company that could take a step up.
They could be the one. And again, look, we've got 90 of them to choose from, right? I mean, there's no shortage of ones to pick and choose from. I think there's going to be another one, and I'm excited to see who that turns out to be. The other thing is I'm hoping to see the continued growth of the smaller war game conventions. And I say growth / regrowth, because in some cases, some of these conventions are still recovering from COVID and having to slowly rebuild those audiences, where it wasn't just that they lost the COVID year. They lost a year or two or three afterwards while still kind of recovering and rebuilding the audience before they could actually afford to, both in terms of dollar figures and public attention, before they could afford to get back on their feet. And we've got a bunch of war game focused conventions starting to grow. We are only one of them. Look, we're 1 year old, right? We had, what, 23 people show up last year. Maybe we get 30 this year. That'd be like a 30, you know, the 20-something% increase. That'd be great. But places like Historic KC Fest and there's Game More out in Oregon, but what was the one up in Seattle? Mo, do you remember the one that the Lock and Load guys used to go to up in Seattle?
They had the World War III con there too.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, and I can't remember what the name is off the top of my head.
Or Circle DC expanding, or SD HISCON. Yeah, Harold's not going to expand. He's just going to create more conventions. Maybe Foxconn takes off a little more and gets beyond their initial 100-person limit and starts to expand. Maybe Compass starts to branch out and do some more other than just right there in their backyard. But I would like to start seeing more and varied and regional, but not in a bad way. Like, let's spread these things around the country so that more people can get to them. I would like to see more of those start to grow up over the next 3, 4, 5 years. And if you're not sure how to pull those off, like, there's enough of us out there doing these things that you can reach out to for some advice, for some help. Call Matt at Historic KC Fest. Call us. Call Kevin for Circle DC. Harold's got like a whole crew of people working for him. There's plenty of folks that are willing to offer some input on how to set up and run that local convention. Reach out to folks and get a hand. We list conventions in our Tuesday Newsday for upcoming events. You know, go reach out to any of those folks and see what you can do. Let's build up that convention scene and get more Wargamers playing with each other. So cool. Guys, this has been fun. I appreciate all y'all taking some time tonight to cover this. So Grant, appreciate you swinging by. I know it's not quite as late for you as it is for the rest of us.
No, it's great to be here. I'm glad I didn't miss a season. I'm glad you tucked me in on the final episode. I feel like I've been in the last three seasons now or something, so I'm feeling good.
Cleanup hitter.
Yeah.
And we'll try and front load you for the fall. We'll get you a little earlier. And Mo, thank you for, you know, coming back around for multiple guest appearances this time around. So
yeah, no, it's always fun, and really appreciate it. And my last thing would be, one thing I would like to see going forward, and just a real quick one, is more community involvement. People want to, you know, say, hey, they want to, you know, criticize game development or rule books or whatever. Well, guess what? You can be the change that you want to see. Volunteer, proofread, get involved in development of games, testing, blind testing, whatever. Get involved, because trust me, publishers want that.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. I mean, and you see it in the newsletters too, like GMT and Compass and Decision and whoever put out calls for playtesters regularly.
Yeah.
Well, I did an episode of my podcast, about 6 months ago, maybe, where we were talking about levy and campaign games and how much we liked them. But we were kind of talking also about how much we really didn't like the rule book for Inferno, for example. Mm-hmm. And Boko Runki heard that episode. He liked our criticisms, thought that they were on point. He didn't get defensive about it, and then he reached out to the two of us and said, hey, why don't you come and help us with this new rule book for the game I'm doing next. So we got dragooned into being proofreaders and playtesters for the next thing he was doing, just because, you know, we stuck our neck out and said we didn't like something that was out there already.
Well, you didn't like it because you care about it. Yeah, and exactly. So that's the proper, that's constructive criticism. That's the proper way to do it. And then he did the right thing, which, you know, you'd expect Vocal to do, which is say, hey, you seem to care about this. Come on and help us. Let's correct it then. And you guys have a passion for it, and he has a passion for his design. So you get those two together and boom, hopefully you get a better rule book out of that, which makes every game in the series from then on out that much better.
Yeah,
I think it speaks to how kind of humble and egoless Volko is, in that he didn't take it as negative criticism, but just a way that he could do something better. You know, an opportunity to go, oh yeah, that makes sense.
No, if you got a legit, you know, complaint or gripe or something like that, you know, Volko's fair-minded. He'll hear it and say, oh, that's a fair point. Hey, how can we do this better? Because there's bias involved on his part, because he's the designer, and he's going to have a bit of bias because he knows the system. He created it, and he's thinking of it in a certain headspace that's different than you or me or anybody else that plays those games. So how do we translate? How do you help him translate from his understanding to where it's understanding, you know, understandable to the general public?
It's a good example of what you said. Like, you know, if you think you've got an idea, you know,
chime in.
If you put it out there and talk to someone, they're looking for help for sure.
100%.
For you know, for buckets of nickels, right? It's like
you too can own your own really fine set of coasters.
Mike, we're going to give the co-host the last word of the night.
Yeah, unless you're talking to that David Thompson character, if you point out even a typo in his stuff, he curses you out and goes ballistic. I mean, he is horrible. No, I'm kidding. So I guess it's our last podcast. So glad to Grant that you were able to get on the tail end of it here with us. I don't know. You probably, since you haven't been on one in a while, remember that Brant will send our gift baskets out next week, and you'll get the check after that. So be looking for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look really, really hard.
The Dragoon swag bag. Yeah, baby. Yeah,
exactly. Once again, we're talking about coasters, aren't we?
It'll be in your mailbox. It's that small.
Coasters of coasters.
Yeah. I have some Dragoons branded pocket lint. So guys, this has been great. It's been a lot of fun tonight. I appreciate y'all swinging by. Audience, thank y'all very much for joining us this season. We're going to take a break for the summer. We will be back in the fall, sometime around Labor Day-ish, as we look forward into the fall with some of the usual things we do with a holiday episode, catalogs and sales. We're going to talk about the fall assembly. We're going to try and maybe go live from the fall assembly. In the meantime, as you're hearing this, you've still got a couple of weeks to make your plans to come join us at Origins. We've got over 100 wargaming events. Just for game events on the calendar. On top of that, we've got another 20 or 30 or so events just from the Dragoons up in the exhibit, in the War College. And we are going to try and live stream a bunch of the War College. Unfortunately, we've lost our original StreamYard dude that was going to be running video production. So if anybody wants to come to Origins on a media badge and work the War College and do a bunch of video production, hit me up, because we need some help with that one. So Grant, now you've got your opportunity to come to Origins. You just need another road trip.
I just have to volunteer to do a video, right?
Yeah, you're gonna get to watch like all these companies give their state of the company talk and watch all these designer panels. We had so many designers on panels, we had to split it into two. So you know, we've got I don't remember who's on which panel, but some combination of Kevin and Tori and Jason Matthews and Ananda Gupta and Bruce Matthews and Fred Schwartz, Jason Matthews, Bruce Maxwell. We've got Tim's going to be on one of them. David Thompson's going to be there the day he's there. So, I mean, we had to split this into multiple panels because we got so many designers going to be there.
And so, Grant, if you do this, you'll get another Armchair Dragoons gift basket. It's worth it.
Oh, the other poster.
You'll get 20s of cents if you go and you get extra video content at that point.
You'll get the other coaster that goes with the first one.
See, now, Bruce Maxwell alone is worth the price of admission. He always gives great presentations.
He's going to be on one of the designer panels, and he's going to be doing a talk on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. So,
if you've not seen that, that is worth sitting down and listening to. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so you're going to get it. You're going to get a double dose of Bruce. Plus, he's going to be there doing three sessions of Air and Armor and another one of NATO. So, yeah. We've got him doing a bunch of stuff. Folks, come see us at Origins. And on the off chance you blow us off for Origins, you can always come back around and catch us next fall on our next season of Mention and Dispatches.